Matthew Reynolds identifies as a same-gender-loving multi-ethnic warrior who traverses the worlds of multimedia performance and education, emphasizing the principles of community, inclusion, and belonging. After 15 years educating students in the Rogue Valley, he created Matthew Reynolds Consulting LLC, an organization focused on cultural agility through experiential learning. Matthew Reynolds Consulting enriches lives through engagement, workshops, and presentations. Last week, he offered a set of workshops on culturally responsive teaching to instructors at Southern Oregon University. And today, we'll learn what it means to be culturally responsive in learning environments and the challenges of integrating experiential learning in educational spaces. Matthew Reynolds is in studio today on The Keenest Observers. Thank you for being here.
Robert, thank you so much for having me here.
Most definitely. Having lived in a variety of communities, countries, and demographics, Matthew has thoroughly honed his communication skills and paired them with an innate generosity toward the perspectives of others. He was named a top five finalist for Oregon Teacher of the Year in 2018, received the honorable mention for the Excellence in Theater Education Award the same year, and was awarded Volunteer and Educator of the Year from Southern Oregon Queer Resource Center at SOU in 2006. So what is it, when you talk about culturally responsive teaching, what does that mean?
There's a definition by Zaretta Hammond that talks about being able to include all the marginalized groups of students that you have in front of you, being able to take their story into consideration when it comes to creating your curriculum, creating possibly the histories that you want to bring up to be able to discuss in class, creating an environment that's safe enough that students feel like they can share those aspects of themselves because there's a connection. They're seen, they're heard, they're not just marginalized and pushed over to the side. And we have a tendency, I feel, in public education in America to teach the winner story, the dominant-centered white story. And so how do we move ourselves away from that and create something new? And I think that that's what culturally responsive teaching is at its core, is creating this new.
You know, before we started, we were both about to talk about our backgrounds coming from rural areas and community. And I know you start your work from a basis of community and identity and then inclusion within spaces. How did that rearing, as we know, we get into this conversation? I know we could probably talk about this a lot and how this founds your work, but how does that rearing connect to what you're talking about?
Most definitely, Robert. So growing up in north central Minnesota in a small town, Isanti, Minnesota, with a population of about 1,500, 1,700 when I was growing up there, my family, a multi-ethnic family, my mother was Irish, German, and Swedish, and my father was African American. We were the only minority family until I reached about the seventh grade. And so we moved there when I was three. I'm the fourth child of six. And so for me, it was really this idea of, well, I see at home my father and my siblings. I see their skin color. I see that the names that I'm being called at school come from the fact of my skin color. So at an early age, I feel that I got an understanding of what community wasn't. And so a lot of it was this idea that I had to change something about myself to fit in. And so I chose the route of always being the happy class clown, joking, everything was funny, trying to be everybody's friend. But in the same breath, you know, from like kindergarten, probably through about eighth grade, I was in a fight 3 to 5 times a week with folks who at one moment were friends and I'm passing notes to whomever it was that they wanted to be their girlfriend or boyfriend that week. And then, you know, the next day I'm being called a racial slur by them and getting into fisticuffs with them. So it was a really confusing time with all of that going on. And then another thing that occurred that a lot of folks didn't know is by the time I graduated high school, I had 3 suicide attempts, you know, and it was that whole facade of, I'm all right, everything is fine, I'm okay on the outside, but inside there was so much going on, a confusion of how I belong anywhere, because I also, at the age of 13, told a good friend of mine that I had a crush on his older brother. And so And at that age, this friend of mine was like, well, that might be a phase that you're going through. So that rhetoric was fed to me very early on as well. So I'm constantly being bombarded by what I'm not supposed to be, what's not accepted. And then went to college and university at the University of Minnesota. I thought, this is great. I'm going to meet more black folk. I'm going to meet more queer folk. Everything's going to be good. And then I was too white for a lot of the black folk that I met. And I was too straight acting and appearing, which is baffles me, for some queer folk that I met when I got to the University of Minnesota. So once again, I was hit with, you're not this, you're not that, so you don't fit in, you know. And I think as I've gotten into education later on in life, a lot of the performance art I created early on was really cathartic, and looking at a lot of those aspects, purging a lot of what I had taken on that wasn't mine to take on of other people's work. So personal introspective work on how they view themselves and view themselves in the world. And then through that art, I found my calling to come here and to get my master's in teaching.
Here as in SOU?
As in SOU, yes, in Southern Oregon. And a lot of that formulated the way in which my pedagogy came forward. And then it was also around that time, maybe a couple of years later, where Brené Brown really took off and a lot of her work started to enter the world. And so looking at her ideas of connection, looking at her ideas of love and belonging, I really started to formulate, this is what I want my classroom to be like. I want it to be a place where students feel they belong, where all of us can belong.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about Brené Brown and that extension into the class period of your time when we come back on the break. And we've already got a call coming in, but we'll hit that after the break as well. I'm talking to Matthew Reynolds, longtime Rogue Valley educator and education consultant, about cultural responsiveness in learning spaces. We'll be back. Stay with us and continue calling in. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking with longtime educator from the Rogue Valley and consultant Matthew Reynolds. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Brené Brown and her work. Can you tell a little bit about that work and how it then further informed your practice in the classroom, and then, you know, that connection into the current work, as we were kind of talking about in the break.
Yes. So I think the main thing that I took from Brené Brown was the gifts of imperfection, her wholehearted way of living. That book profoundly affected myself and my classes. I purchased a classroom set and started reading it with my advanced and senior drama class. And for them to get this idea of what I'm worthy now, and how it opened up so quickly and so clearly that in these formative years when cognitively our brain is developing, a lot of times that sense of self-worth is really what's being bombarded by pop culture, by socialization, by the white dominant idea story that's being fed to us, that is, you know, led by, when I use the word white supremacist, I'm not talking about alt-right or hate groups or anything like that. I'm talking about the idea that the dominant culture has been white in our country. And so this white dominant hierarchical, patriarchal, capitalistic system has bombarded a lot of our youth into believing particular ideas about themselves, which a lot of times leaves them feeling unworthy of just being who they are and belonging. So for you to fit into my classroom, right, you have to leave this at the door. You have to leave that at the door. For you to fit in to my plays or the theater, you have to leave this at the door, leave that at the door. And that is nothing that I ever wanted to do. And so it was this idea of belonging. Oh, you belong here. Bring the ugly, the dirty, the nasty, the funky, the joyful, the exuberant, etc. Bring all of it here. And that's true belonging. And then we're really going to go somewhere when we have that sense of self-worth that all of us are worthy to be here in this moment together.
Right. In my time, we used to say, bring yourself to bear.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Yeah.
Most definitely. And so, like, the community, I'm hearing the connection, right, with, you know, the foundations of, you know, it's always personal to, I think, you know, the nature of then moving to what you feel your calling is. And I think that that's an interesting, you know, story to hear, like, you know, the personal isolation within your own background and then coming into finding your own, you know, the self-awareness of developing your own identity informed your practice.
Yes.
But then how, like, quickly did you see that need within the spaces that you engaged in the classroom? Because you ended up staying here in Southern Oregon after your graduate studies, correct?
I did. I was fortunate enough that my mentor teacher decided that they wanted to retire and asked if I'd be willing to apply for the position. And I did, and I got it. And so I stayed here and helped develop a school. And so in that time, one of the things that I took away from the MAT program here when we wrote our philosophy of education is this idea of community. So all of my class periods created their own pledge. And so each class period I would take, sometimes it would take 2 weeks, so maybe 10 class periods or maybe a few more. But every year, all six class periods would come up with their own pledge. And so that pledge then was geared off of maybe we would look at the third verse of the national anthem, or maybe we'd look at the Pledge of Allegiance, or we'd look at the ideas of nationalism and what does that all mean to you at this age? And then what do you think that meant as far as community goes here in the United States? And so how did that formulate the way in which you interacted with each other? And a lot of times it was like, wow, it didn't. And I didn't know why I was saying it. I don't know where some of those words were at younger age. I don't know where it came from. And so that would lead to this idea of, well, if you had community, what would you need? And then there would be a list of words that would get formulated. Everybody would have their own. We would come up with a master list of words where everybody's voice felt like, or everybody felt that their voice was part of it. Then every person would take a chance to write their own pledge using that list of words. Therefore, everybody felt like they were within it. And sometimes it was I pledge or we pledge, or sometimes it was poetry, sometimes it was a story, sometimes it took on, and then the class got an opportunity to vote on which one would govern the class in a way, so the one that we would read. So the usual rules and regulations of a classroom were taken over by this pledge, and so I'd have students that would come in and be like, I had a rough time outside of here, or I'm having a rough time with someone in here, can we read the pledge again today? And of course it was like this idea of something that we were striving towards. It wasn't necessarily you have to live this way, you've got to be this way kind of idea.
Yeah, before we kind of connect that to then, you know, why the performing arts maybe helps that, and then, you know, how this connects to your consulting practice and what you did at SOU last week, I want to give you some kudos from the community that just hit. This is from Kim Cried, who says, thank you, Matthew, for doing the hard work to keep a loving heart and to share that light with everyone. So I want to just give you that, because sometimes that's hard to, as we continue to move and practice, having that voice from folk or out in the world to know that this is what you should be doing is a good thing to hear.
And thank you, Kim. Kim's back in Minnesota.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, she's a friend of the family.
Okay, right on. Good to have good folk listening, too.
Yes, 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 yes.
Well, why do you, you know, you chose the performing arts to kind of, you know, apply, you know, this work. What do you think about the performing arts and media, and why do you think that is a good tool for this kind of space offering, if you will?
Because I feel that the performing arts were the storytellers of the earth-based religions that we slaughtered basically, here and around the world to get that white dominant story to be the winner story. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that the performing arts, the storytellers, are the ones who keep the culture alive, keep the story moving forward, keep us connected, even when we start to feel even more disconnected. Those stories come up and allow us to reflect upon whom we see out there in that story, up on that stage with our own personal lived experience, or for us to honor and witness for other people who are sitting there with us, and going through that reflection, that self-reflection. And I think it really brings us into this idea of community. I think live theater is one of the most integral aspects of community that we still have these days. Others might venture to say that it's a sporting event. Others might venture to say that it's politics, etc. But I lean definitely towards the idea that it's live theater that creates this sense of community. And from that idea of theater, you know, a lot of folks were like, well, can I use this pledge idea in my math class? Can I take it to my science class? Can I do this? And it's like, of course, you can take this anywhere that you would like to. I presented this at a national conference with the Coalition of Essential Schools, having pledges and being able to utilize them in various aspects and in different subject matters. And that same idea of community, if I'm going to be sitting in a class that I feel I'm weak in, It's an intimate thing for me then to be there, because I need to share and show my vulnerability that I'm not strong in this subject area. Hmm. And so for that to be able to happen, it can't be a teacher who's standing up there and only calling on the people whose hands are raised. That teacher needs to be able to see all their students in the classroom, know how to support and lift up all of them in there, and also instill that in that compassion and that empathy in other students to want to help one another out.
And so I'm guessing then this becomes not only pedagogy, but then route to as you pull into the consulting arena, mm-hmm. applying that to like how folk develop their own awareness in educational spaces as instructors to be able to do just that.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was part of the work that we did last Friday here at SOU with about 56 staff and professors. And I just kind of started it off, got them thinking about their idea of what an equity lens should look like. So for me, I feel that through socialization and pop culture and that winner's story, the lens that we either orbit around, navigate, the first one that we start to look through or that we see and we don't want to look through, is that white supremacist, hierarchical, patriarchal, capitalistic system. And I always have a tendency to raise my left fist and point at that when I'm talking about that. Mm. And what I'm trying to get people to do is to think about that equity lens first. Think about, well, what is my equity lens? What is my lived experience? What is my culture personally that I bring to any situation that I feel seen and heard, and that people are actually, there's a good exchange and rapport with everybody in the room. And then I want that equity lens to be the one that people are looking through. I want to start, a lot of people say, well, I'm a bridge builder. And then I say, well, what are you building a bridge towards? Mm. And a lot of times they can't tell me. Mm. More often than not, they can't. Because it goes back to this first lens, and people are just looking at that lens or trying to not be a part of that. But let's get to the point where let's actually start building some new things. We can't just wipe everything off the board. I understand that. But we can move away from what's not working. And what's not working is the winner story that we're all using right now or trying to not use. Let's start building. I really want to start building some new stuff. And then I think that that'll take the equity lens for us to really try to do that.
Hmm. I'm talking to Matthew Reynolds, education consultant and longtime Rogue Valley educator. Interestingly enough, you know, you're bringing up this construct of the winner story. Why do you find that that's threatening, not only to, you know, the community, but to the individuals within community? And I'm saying maybe just more so the acclimation and education of, like, students.
Do you want it from a interpersonal perspective, or do you want Met information and like statistics?
I want you to bring it how you need to bring it. Yeah, because interestingly that you respond that way, because I what ultimately happens to me when I hear, you know, that response is that, again, like you said, you're trying to find, you know, we're trying to socialize students and young people to be able to go through the system that is life, mm-hmm. right? But if we try, if we ignore, it's just what you said, if we ignore who they are, then we do it at our own peril, in my opinion. But that's not everyone's opinion. In fact, you know, even mm-hmm. folks within, you know, those individual cultures will say, no, that's a skill that you need to learn mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in order to navigate the mm-hmm. world. So,
and I think by the state of our world right now, from a climate perspective, from a socioeconomic perspective, from a human spirit perspective, that idea is failing miserably, and it's failing tons of people. It's killing our planet. It's not helping people to be their biggest and fullest and brightest. It's telling people you have to cut off these aspects of yourself so that you fit in. It has nothing whatsoever to do with belonging. And I think we all belong here as human beings. And so if I look at the school to prison pipeline, for instance, mm-hmm. or if I look at the idea that if you don't meet these test scores in science and math and technology, then you're a failing school. Mm-hmm. Because those are the three areas that are going to keep us in the world economic culture as a country. But we're not taking into consideration what you were talking about before. What is a student intrinsically drawn towards? What are they passionate about? What are they going to give their all towards so that humanity can flourish? And if we're cutting that off, saying, no, we need this capitalistic gain to be able to stay a power in the world, so forget about that and become good in these areas. And it doesn't mean that there aren't students who are good in those areas. But if we try to squish all students into that same idea and perspective, it's not human nature to me. And I think that there's plenty of science out there that proves that that's true. So, and I don't think that it takes on, a lot of people now will listen to what I'm saying, and all of a sudden now they'll say, well, now you've stepped into the political arena, and now you've taken this political stance with it. And I'm going to push back on that and say, no, I haven't. I'm standing strong as a human being, and I'm pushing back with human nature is what I'm pushing back with, not politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want us to get into how you apply that to your consulting work. We have a question that I'd like you to get to in the next couple minutes that we have left in this segment. How do we keep sensitive kids engaged and aware of their white privilege without making them feel shame and thereby disengaging? A friend's child has started shrinking away from discussions about race and equity and feels ashamed of being white because of all the awareness being raised at school and plays at OSF, particularly between two knees last year at OSF. Thanks. I'm grateful for having Matthew in our community. And that's Kat Gold from Ashland.
Thank you, Kat, for sure. We were just talking about that ever just so slightly. I don't think that I don't think that everybody can do this work in a way that is nurturing, is empathetic, is compassionate, and has the end goal in mind of helping everybody be their biggest, fullest, and brightest. I think sometimes there's work that I personally need to do around certain areas. And sometimes that comes up when I am in front of a group of people and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I didn't know I was going to get hit with that today. Thank you for bringing that up, but I'm going to need to process that. And I don't want to process that on you or in front of you. And so I reserve that right for myself to step aside and to do that on my own. The reason I think that there's such a cacophony and like backlash is because for hundreds of years, it has been the winner's story. hundreds upon hundreds of years, generation after generation. And it's to do this work is a very intimate, compassionate thing. And so to all of a sudden have this training about it and just be like, okay, I'm going to point this out and these discrepancies out without talking about the fact that I need to have community in this room. I need to make sure that people understand that your vulnerability and your discomfort is going to be part of this process. It has to be. And that makes it a very intimate situation. And if you're not willing to have that intimate situation in this larger group setting or for your company, your theater, your school, then we need to look at another route to be able to do that, because it's going to take all of us going through some discomfort. It's a growth mindset then, right? That fixed mindset is when we stay in comfort. That fixed mindset has complacency and being complicit to it. Whereas our discomfort brings us to that growth mindset where we start learning things about ourselves, learning things about the people who are around us, and learning things about our own personal ideas of community. So I don't think that we can just go see, especially between two knees, by yourself and not have some kind of reflection afterwards. Even, you know, because I loved it and I thought it was unapologetic and it had its place, and that people needed to see it, but people also needed to discuss afterwards, I think.
We're talking to Matthew Reynolds, education consultant, and we'll continue the conversation of how to deal with the discomfort sometimes of doing work of the equity and between two knees after the break. We're back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting my guest, education consultant Matthew Reynolds. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to also make the bridge from the question that we got from Kat Gold about students disengaging in challenges of and when dealing with the challenges of encountering the uncomfort or discomfort, as you said, about race and equity. But I think it's very interesting how you just termed it, being explicit about the fact that part of learning is really dealing with the bridge of one side, like you were mentioning, and the discomfort of what it is to undergo the process of learning is like the explicit thing that I would suggest would need to be a part of that parents' conversation with that youth. And in fact, saying, hey, this is going to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It may be something that you find challenging.
Yes. And I think that a huge part of let me take a step back, because all of a sudden about five ideas came slamming forward. We have never been here before. And when I say we, I'm talking we as humanity and we as the United States. It has always been the winner's story. 80% plus of the teachers are middle-aged white women in the U.S. in public education. I was part of a less than 1% when I was in the classroom still as a black identified male. And so when we look at that and we look at the story that keeps being taught over and over again, how do we make sure that students are feeling comfortable and safe when a lot of the educators are feeling the same discomfort that the student is? And they haven't gone through some kind of personal look at, well, how am I affected with this? I'm modeling for my students. I'm here in front of my students and they're watching how I'm navigating a lot of this. But wait, that training really didn't bring up for me the intimacy that this is really going to take for me to do a lot of this. Yes, I have this lesson plan. Yes, I can take them through maybe this unit. Oh, look, it's Black History Month. Now I can plug these things in because I've been given permission to during this chunk of time, but that's it. And that's the only time that I'm going to do this. And I don't have to really interact with it with my student, right? Hmm. And so now that all of this is starting to come to the surface, we're in new territory and people have no idea. I do not have an equity lens that I can say, this is what an equity lens is. And so this is how you are going to use it. I'm coming in when I do my consulting and I'm helping you find your personal equity lens. So every person who is in the room finds their own personal equity lens. Then if it's a school district, then we turn it on to your policies and procedures, which you've sent me before. I've combed through for racist language, misogynistic language, et cetera, and I'm moving those things around, and then we can turn your personal equity lens onto those policies and procedures to then find things that we can qualitative information that we can look at over the next 3, 6, 9 months that we can measure to see that the culture has changed. It can't just be these three teachers are teaching this lesson in their class. How do we change the entire culture of the school district? Right? How do we change the entire culture of the theater company? How do we change the entire culture of America? Because I think it's up for grabs. I think we're seeing as the poverty grows and increases and middle class is disappearing and we go to places like Seattle or forget that, driving south from Medford to here and all the tents of the houseless people we see on the right-hand side and how that's increasing and the number of people walking along I-5 there to get into town, we see that this idea, the winter story that we're trying to perpetrate is not working and it's failing humanity. And so how do we find something new without rebuilding the same thing and structuring the same thing? And I feel we need to get to that place of looking through a different lens, and that lens is an equity lens.
So when you talk about, for clarity, the winter story, can you tell me what you mean by that? And then how that then connects into the disruption that you want to see, not only just for schools. So I think that was really, you know, it's really important that we also say, you know, you consult for organizations as well as school systems.
Yes. I've said it a couple of times already. I'll say it again. It's the white dominant culture, the white supremacist, hierarchical, patriarchal, capitalistic system, which I feel is American culture. When I ask a lot of folks, what's American culture? You know, they can't really give it to me. And then some people will give me what is considered to be subcultures. They'll talk from the Black culture perspective. They'll talk from the queer culture perspective. They'll talk from the Native perspective. They'll talk from women's perspective. They'll talk then women's perspective underneath all those other three, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of people don't talk about the fact that this country was created off of a white man's ideas of what democracy stolen from the Iroquois peoples was. And the Iroquois peoples, it was more of a maternal idea than it is the paternal idea that we have now. And so if we look at all these historical points of reference, the only history that we come up with, you know, is this white supremacist, hierarchical, patriarchal, capitalistic system. And that's what keeps perpetuating these ideas of what we should be. And that's why the 1% have all that they do and why everything else is falling away and getting larger, because it doesn't work for everybody. And now I can hear it already. Oh, so you're a socialist or you're a communist. And once again, I push back against those political things and I ask you to dig a little bit deeper and look at humanity and look at love and compassion in the way that we act towards one another and treat one another. I don't want to be tolerated. I want to be accepted as another human being. You don't have to like everything and agree with everything I have to say. We're not supposed to do that, I feel. But in the same breath, you shouldn't use name calling and et cetera to exterminate my life or my way of being so that I can become part of the great American melting pot either. You know? Yes, you should see my color. My color is beautiful. It's gorgeous. And the love of two people, someone who was identified and seen as white and someone who was seen as black, who left Illinois because it was unsafe for the two of them to date my parents, that's not that long ago, and traveled up to Minnesota, created this beautiful skin. I hope you see it, because it was based on love. And now people are like, oh, he's all hippie now, so great, but that's where I'm at. That's how I feel.
And so we are talking to he who is education consultant Matthew Reynolds. I think that is very interesting in a time when our ethnic demographic is what it is across the board, that it seems like you're saying that an interruption about our not only history has to be integrated into how we educate and not only youth, but people, because that space hasn't been, and history hasn't been presented to the us as a whole. But what you're talking about really does influence education and systemics across the board in our society.
I'm serious when I say I feel that the American culture is up for grabs. I really believe that. I believe that we're such a young nation, and it was John Stewart when all this started to kick off, who said we really are one of the only places in the world that has all the ethnicities, faiths, and belief systems, the amount of people that are living here with such a diverse background that nowhere else in the world is doing what we're doing. And I feel that we, if we start shifting some of these ideas to and looking through that equity lens and looking at belonging and really starting to have us go from that place of passion within ourselves to be our biggest, fullest, and brightest, that we can create something that is worthy of saying, oh, wow, America's pretty great. You know what I mean? It's like right now, the winner story did not do that.
So what are the obstructions as you've gone into systems, school systems, and organizations that you've seen to this philosophy?
Fear.
Flat out fear.
I don't know who you are. I don't know what's going on. And now I can tie that to everything. It's like, I think one of the biggest things that I've taken from Dr. Heidi Olivadotti here in the Valley is that if you are being harmful or hurtful to students, to youth, I will fight you tooth and nail at that point.
And who is that? Can you tell me?
They, when you have a school board or superintendent or even some educators, you know, educators who we have students that are trans and they want to, they have a particular name they would like to be referred to or pronouns they'd like to be referred by, and that teacher says, no, they're not going to do that. That's hurtful and that's harmful. When you have teachers who aren't willing to give up a bathroom, one of their bathrooms, to call it a all gender inclusive bathroom, that's hurtful and harmful to students. Right? And if you have a superintendent who wants to post something publicly on social media that all of a sudden starts a dialogue that has a lot of aggression and hatred in it that could lead to physical violence, that's harmful to students. And so if you can't see that those are the things that you are doing, you are not in the right profession. You should not be working with students, and you need to change that. And move out of that profession, as far as I'm concerned. And so that ties in, I think, with the fear. A lot of times it's just plain old fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of what the pushback might be from other parents or the louder voice in the room or the loudest voice in the room, et cetera, or fear of right now, like I said, we've never come from a place with an equity lens. No one knows what that looks like. No one knows if it's going to be a success or a failure, you know, kind of thing. But if we don't fail, first attempt in learning and try to learn some new things and have that growth mindset and allow ourselves to grow and grow through it and be able to support each other through it, then we're just going to keep cycling back in this catch-22, which is not serving humanity.
Mm-hmm. Again, like I have a set of friends that are educators, longtime educators that come and say a lot and have real strong dialogue about whether or not they're doing work to develop learning and the ability to learn and analyze, or to make folk who understand how to engage in systems. And I just tend to catch the wall and just listen.
Right. I think Paulo Freire, I'm going to, if you're hearing some noise, it's me reaching in to get a picture of the quote that I used of his recently on Friday with the SOU. It's the last, professors, it's the last quote that I put up for them. Let's see here if I can find it.
And Paulo Freire, for folks, is a long theater practitioner and educator who wrote a very similar work called Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Yes.
And, as well as a number of texts that have been used in school systems and theater training institutions, as well as regional and commercial theater and film.
And that's, you know, in reading his Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that's where a lot of this mindset comes from. You know, when we're looking at, well, what does it mean to be an educator? Am I guiding students to their own learning, to their own understanding, so that they can come up with new ways of looking at things? Or am I just indoctrinating them into the conformity of the winner's story to keep perpetuating that? And I think one of the things that I've seen in the education practice right now is the fear of technology. A lot of folks my age, or the teachers who've been there for 30 years, didn't have these technologies prior. So the personal fear of, I don't know how to run this technology, et cetera, et cetera. So this generation that's going through right now, they've had this technology since birth. How do we nurture that?
Right, and develop it, and then also bridge to those folks who haven't.
Exactly.
Matthew Reynolds, thank you for your time, and I look forward to hearing what you do with your consulting work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Most definitely. That's it for today's exchange. You can learn more about the program, listen to the program, or suggest a guest at our website, jeffexchange.org. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. The Exchange is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, stay tuned for the news from the BBC.